Good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Maureen Freely, and my job this evening is to give a big welcome to Helen Simpson. Just give you a little bit of background. I'm sure you all know what I'm about to tell you. She came onto the scene, made a big impression in 1990 with a collection of short stories called Four Bare Legs in a Bed. And then there was another collection in 1995 called Dear George. In 1991, not long after she was published, first published, she won the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award. In 1993, she won the Somerset Mom Award. And in 1993, also, she was one of Granta's 20 best young British novelists. And they've all done quite well. Her new book, a collection of short stories, is Hey, Yeah, Right, Get a Life. I didn't say that with enough expression. And it's been very, very well received by everybody. It's all of the stories in it are about mothers and young children and very bad babysitters, which is a subject you'd think we'd covered very well already, but there's something about these stories which takes this very old subject and turns it around entirely, opens it up, and says things that have never really been said before, looks at things that have never been looked before. It's quite an extraordinary collection. Esther Freud said of it is that the stories detailed all the things you try to forget once your children are in bed. A lot of the other reviewers felt that even though it was quite a limited subject area, that it should be, because they were so beautifully written, and because they opened up all these new subjects, it really should be for a very wide audience. And so I'm glad that we have a very wide audience here tonight. And now I'll hand over to you.
Thank you. Thanks.
Did you want to use that door?
Yes, do stand up and read.
Yeah, yes. Whatever you want.
All right. Oh, it's not a microphone, yes. I'm going to read a story. This collection was much more narrow subject matter than my other two collections. The focus was tighter. And it was odd when I read through at the end. It added up to something. But this, they're not all about babysitters and babies, so I'm sure you don't want to hear a babysitting story tonight, so I'll read this one, which is about shopping, really, and clothes. It's called Wurstigkeit. What have you told them at work, she asked. What have you told them at yours, I countered. I don't need to tell them anything, she said, looking down her long nose at me unsmilingly. I'm in charge. We have met as arranged on the pavement outside the Huguenot house in Fournier Street, the one whose area railings are headed with thistles rather than spears. I had been out east that morning to see the man at the regulators about some recent embarrassing losses suffered by Leviathan Bank, whose compliance department I was running. On the way back from Canary Wharf to my lunchtime assignation in Spitalfields, I'd had the bad luck to be driven by one of those furious, obsessive cabbies who hate traffic and know a thousand secrets about London's back streets. He scorned the obvious routes, refused Commercial Road, shot off up in the direction of Bow, then lost his temper at the first red light, and tore off round Salmon Lane to grind to a swearing, cursing, and of course entirely foreseeable halt on the Mile End Road. I was feeling mildly sick by this point, but he would not be satisfied until he'd swung us madly north up into Bethnal Green. And at Weaver's Fields I began to despair of ever escaping, but then at last he dropped me at the top of Brick Lane, expressing indignant incredulity at the one-way system, which, as any child knows, is nothing if not long established. Even so, I was early. I was feeling buoyant and restless when I looked forward to the next hour or so. While I waited for Isabel Marley, I watched an old man running for a bus which had overshot the stop. He was creeping along, legs low down like a jaguar stealthily approaching its prey through the rainforest, with a broad, ingratiating grin of pain on his face. I'm not really young anymore, it came to me, wincing in sympathy. But then, cheering up, I'm not that old yet either. Isabel's black cab drew up at last, gleaming and purring. She took her time unpacking her long-limbed, full-bellied self from the back. It had taken her over 20 minutes just from Gray's Inn Road, and she made the driver write out a receipt. We exchanged nods, avoiding each other's eyes. Guilt and complicity hovered in the air like creaky old stage conventions. "So," she said, after we'd exchanged formal greetings, "where is this secret cavern of temptation?" "I'm not allowed to say," I said truthfully. "You'll just have to follow me." "That's ridiculous," she hissed, as I led her down past Fashion Street and the police station, then left into Chicksand Street. "Ludicrous. Who do they think they are?" I'd met Isabel Marley 2 days before at Idem Featherstone's reception for their corporate finance clients in Seething Lane. Idem Featherstone is a smallish law firm, and its partners are always hoping I'll put work their way. Sometimes I do. I went along this time because I'm curious about their mooted merger with the German law firm Marbiter Rottenhart, which is looking both inevitable and, for some Idem Featherstone partners, disastrous. "Trouble is, Laura, we need more than a toehold in Frankfurt," fretted John Mannion, head of corporate finance. "We may not like it, but we've got to bite the bullet." "Difficult," I commiserated, taking a sip of mineral water. I glanced round the room. It was a picture by Manet rather than Monet. Everyone there was in the self-concealing monochrome of corporate life. The only flashes of colour to contradict the moonlit effect were provided by the men's ties. Not far from us, a very tall, strong-featured woman stood talking to Idem Featherstone's managing partner, Graham Groton. She must have been 6 or 7 months pregnant, and I couldn't help thinking how much better pregnancy looks in tailored worsted than in the more traditional maternity smocks. "Of course, it's the way the whole world's having to go now," I said. "There's been a positive stampede of mergers in the broking sector. Everyone's very jumpy." We both watched as a waiter approached and the tall woman held out her glass for more champagne. "That's illegal now, isn't it?" said John Mannion, boozing while up the duff. "You'd get lynched in the States for less than that." "Good luck to her," I said. "It'll be her fourth," said John Mannion. And for a moment, I thought he was referring to her alcohol intake. "Isabel Marley, QC, she's done a great job for us on that money laundering case in the Philippines." "Oh, yes," I frowned, recognising the name from an article about high-flying women in that week's Financial Times. "In the updraft." We watched Graham Groton raise his glass to her. He's rather short, Graham, and she was having to talk down to him. "I only like tall men," I said flippantly. I'd been working like a maniac towards the CGGI deal that the board kept insisting should go ahead, despite all the counterindications of shadiness I'd been urging them to consider. My integrity was on the line. The man I'd met earlier that year and whom I might, given time, have grown to love, had understandably grown tired during this CGGI case of waiting until 10 or 11 at night for my work-weary self to grace him with an hour or two, and had gone. "I like to look up at a man," I explained. "Two," said John Mannion, with a startled roll of the eye. I realised he was several inches taller than me. "No, at," I said, and smiled. "Ah," he said, "got you. But let me introduce you to Isabel. You must meet her." Isabel Marley had been listening for long enough to Graham Groton's gung-ho line on the merger and how we were all now part of one big European family for her face to register as we approached, a flash almost of joy. Only almost, for her face was singularly serious, impressively so, and, except for the odd luxury of a frown, impassive. "But how can Europe be one big happy family?" I launched in, unable to let this go. It was Europe's various madly conflicting regulatory regimes which had kept me on 15-hour days these last 2 months. A deal which was whiter than white in one country could be distinctly off-colour in another and downright criminal in a third. The euro wasn't the half of it. "You must feel like the Lone Ranger," chuckled John Mannion. "You and the other compliance guys galloping round after the outlaws, them thar traders." "Hi-ho, silver," I said. "Someone's got to do it." "Not exactly bad news for law firms," said Isabel. But her heart wasn't in it. She had been distracted. She had noticed what no man would ever notice. At this point, John Mannion and Graham Groton were drawn away by another Idun Featherstone partner to meet the Crown Eminence from Marby to Rottenheart, who was over in London on a rare dynastic visit. Isabel paused, then allowed herself to comment, "That's a nice shirt." I was wearing a white shirt with my grey suit, boringly meek and plain. Only a member of the unofficial ocular Freemasonry would have noticed that it was made of nun's veiling, with a faint grey stripe the width of a pencil lead. Why, I remember asking the sales assistant at Wurstigkeit that time, staring hard at the beautiful, but after all, plain shirt. Why, is it so much money, this one? "Ah, this one," he had replied. "Look, there, the stripe, you see? It is because the line is broken." Sure enough, there were minute sugar grain-sized gaps in the fine stripe. "Of course," I'd said, and bought it. "Thank you," I now said to Isabel. I saw her struggling with herself. She was an intensely competitive type, that much was obvious, and she would not be able to bear not to ask. "It's nice cloth," I taunted, almost laughing. "It's like down against the sick skin. And see, the line is broken." I held out my cuff for inspection. "So it is," she said. "Yes." She paused again, poker-faced, then could not help herself and asked, "It's not from that shop, is it? That mad shop with the password where they won't give out their address. What's it called?" "Wurstigkeit," I said, blushing slightly. "What a ludicrous idea, a shop with a password," she scoffed. She couldn't bear to feel excluded, it was obvious. She was used to being on every list, right at the top. "It's eccentric," I agreed, blithely. "Isn't it terribly expensive?" she sniffed. "Not to someone in the updraft," I said, "surely." It was far too expensive for me now, but I wasn't going to tell her that. Since I first visited, Wurstigkeit's prices had quintupled, sextupled, rising by at least 100% each year. Market forces. 5 years ago, I'd met a man from Shibui Investments for lunch in a restaurant near Liverpool Street. He had been summoned by his mobile to an emergency deal-breaker before we had finished the Amuse Girls. And so, finding myself with a rare uncharted hour, I had allowed myself to drift outside mapless into the dusty sun. It was at a point in my life when I could not sleep for worrying. I was starting to experience low-level panic attacks at night when I could hear my jumpy heart and ragged breathing as myriad horrors, regrets, fears, and rawheads hurtled towards me, lying doggo beside my now ex-husband pretending to sleep, in a shower of meteorites. I had taken to carrying with me in my briefcase a collection of small bottles of flowerdew remedies, each claiming to protect against a specific misery. The ones I used most were rock water, labelled for the self-repressed who overwork and deny themselves any relaxation, and wood betony, for those who find it difficult to love themselves. Anyway, it's during this window-like hour, at a less than euphoric stage in my life, that by chance I stumbled into Wurstigkeit, which had opened only that week. It was like stepping into the fabled wardrobe and finding yourself in another country. The point was, it was an experience in weightlessness. It subtracted your centre of gravity. "Wurstigkeit," said Isabel, "I wonder what that means." "Sausage, something it sounds like." "Laura," said John Mannion, waltzing up with an older man in tow. "Laura, I'd like you to meet Gunther Mangelkammer. Herr Mangelkammer is head of commercial litigation over in Frankfurt. Herr Mangelkammer, this is Laura Collinson, head of compliance at Leviathan. And this is the distinguished QC, Isabel Marley." "How fortunate," said Isabel, smiling at Herr Mangelkammer. "We were just puzzling over the meaning of a German word. Perhaps you'll be able to help us." "I might be delighted," said Herr Mangelkammer warily. "What was it, Laura?" Isabel asked. "Wurstigkeit," I said. "Ah, yes," said Herr Mangelkammer, visibly relieved. "I know this. It is an expression introduced by Bismarck. It describes a mental state. How must I say? To do with sausages." "Sausages?" said John Mannion, his eyebrows in his hair. "A state of sausage-like behaviour," persisted Herr Mangelkammer. "Sausageness," I put forward. "Sausageness is good," he agreed, "meaning people don't care. They don't care a sausage's worth." "They don't give a fig," I offered. "They don't give a fuck," cried John Mannion, laughing heartily. "They don't give a flying fuck." "Your way is better, I think," said Herr Mangelkammer, honouring me with a nod. We turn from Chicksand Street into Frostrip Walk, then down a villainous, urinous alley, so narrow that where a moment before there had been enough blue sky above to cut out a pair of sailor's trousers, now there was nothing but a forget-me-not ribbon. "Are you quite sure you know where you're going?" asked Isabel with some asperity as she picked her well-shod way between various noisome puddles. "We took a twist at the end here, then on to one last dark paved lane, and we had arrived." "You must be joking," said Isabel flatly, staring at the scuffed and numberless portal with the blacked-out picture window beside it. She glanced at her watch with irritation, then at me. "Wait a moment," I said. On the wall at the level where a doorbell should have been was the bas-relief head of a satyr, and into the ancient world ear of this creature I whispered the password. Then I stepped back and waited. The door opened slowly on backward hinges, and we followed. Inside, it was the hall of the Mountain King, filled with the trousseau of his robber bride. I caught my breath and started to feel bouncy and oxygenated, airy and greedy. My eyes lusted around all over the place. The colours teased and tingled and clashed like music while the walls receded into velvety darkness. I tried to keep some semblance of indifference, but the smiles kept crossing my lips, and soon I was cooing and clucking and gasping as I moved from rail to rail. Isabel riffled through this rack and that, pursing her lips. I saw the stuff through her eyes as when I'd looked in for the first time 5 years ago. What a load of tat, I'd thought. What a heap of magpie rubbish, little bright bits of rubbish. Then I'd suddenly got caught. Was it a corsair's slanted stripes down the front of a structured cardigan? I'd thought, how can they charge more than a fiver for this nonsense? And a second later, the scales had fallen from my eyes. I'd understood that here was something indefensible at work and had reached for my checkbook. It was the story of the Emperor's new clothes, but backwards. Now Isabel was reaching for the price tags and huffing and puffing and casting stuff aside with a curled lip. "Don't look at the price tags," I advised. "Look at the clothes." I took a long Viridian garment from its hanger and held it out behind her. Instinctively, she slid her arms back into the sleeves and shrugged it on. We looked at her guarded face in the long mirror and at the Grande Dame opera coat whose plaited, puffy, serpentine collar she had drawn superbly up to her chin. "No," she said, casting it aside, "I'd never wear it. When would I wear it?" "Well, that's not the point," I started to say, but decided to wait. Perhaps, after all, she was merely status-seeking, an acquisitive, label-conscious shopper. If so, I had misjudged, and this was a waste of time. I remembered that FTR interview with Isabel Marley. A blur of phrases came back at me, things like 120%, Super League, total commitment, that sort of stuff. She'd been quoted as saying, "I'm a workaholic, I'm fantastically good at what I do," and had rejected the sobriquet of Fat Cat with talk of freedom and markets. That was all distinctly unpromising. Surely she had no time for anything else. On the other hand, she had been the one to fall in love with a shirt, I reminded myself, so she must have something. "There's nothing here that I could wear to work," she said. "There's nothing here that I could wear at home. Family life. What's the point?" "But it's you, that coat. You can see that," I declared. "Apotheosis clothes. That's what this place is for." "You'd never look at me and think, there goes a well-dressed woman. Outside work, I do not dress to please anyone except myself. The concept of rational dress has always appealed strongly. Useful pockets and plimsolls and William Morris's thoughts on vegetable dyes. If I want to look like a happy mad woman, I can. I'm paying for these clothes. I'm having fun. All this goes against the revered French approach. The top two buttons undone, the neat waist cinched, the short, short skirt. The French wouldn't like this shop. It's too eccentric. There's too much colour. And as for that vile, cynical Gallic maxim which holds that clothes should be chosen expressly pour mettre en valeur various good bits of the body. Leg or breast, sir? Bah, I say to this. A bas les vêtements pimpants. Pimp clothes, I call them. And for your information, no, I am not fat. Nor am I thin. I'm just right. Then Isabel caved in. Her defences crumbled, reason fled. She didn't care about the money anymore. She stopped looking at the little tickets and their prices. Instead, she narrowed her eyes and started to hunt down the most fantastical, the most artfully bizarre. I knew I hadn't been mistaken. I knew she had an eye. We were two of a kind when it came to this. She caught on, she was caught in. From now on, she was a driven woman. Soon, we'd amassed enough between us to start trying on. In the little side lavatory off the showroom, Wurstigkeit had nothing as utilitarian as a changing room, with silks and velvets over the rusted old wash basin, elbows in each other's faces, we struggled into mad dresses, lunatic ensembles. I barely knew this woman. I'd only met her once before, yet here we were taking off our clothes together in a rusty cubicle. I tried on a cotton shirt first, raspberry-coloured and almost raspberry-scented as I pulled it over my head. I could smell the cleanness of the cotton and the pleasant smell of our sweat, recent, slight and grassy, then wafting stronger from under our arms. Touching the cotton to my face, my cheek, I found it as fine as a baby's skin and sighed. She's much taller than me, Isabel. I'm not short, but my eyes were level with the great mammalonated nipples of pregnancy spread out by the gauze of her bra. I looked away. I hoped she wouldn't appraise what she saw of me with that merciless female regard which is so chilling. You must have seen the way women look at each other in dressing rooms or at the gym. Furtive, assessing, without lust or kindness. Hypocritically alert to any sign of age or deterioration. No wonder there's so little nakedness in British life. We live under a cloud inside our clothes, blue-veined as cheese, bluish-white as milk. I would love to hold a baby again, I said, thinking back to that good, dense beanbag weight. For half an hour, she said shortly, struggling inside a hiss of silk. I'm not that keen on babies per se. Her head surfaced above the glinting tussore and she scowled. She really did look impressive when she scowled, her features baroque and curly round the long straight nose. All those vile health visitors in hospital moralising about breastfeeding, she shuddered. It's on the tip of my tongue to mention antibodies, just for fun, but I thought she might punch me in the face. When I had my daughter, I expressed my milk at home and at work. The freezer hoarded those precious cubes for the nanny to defrost. I carried the agonising breast pump round in my handbag as reverently as if it were a holy relic. The milk I managed to collect in the ladies at work I stored at the back of the office fridge in a clearly marked bottle until I could take it home. I stopped all that rather abruptly when my secretary one day came and whispered to me that there was a rumour that the boys in sales were adding vodka to the milk, which is the sort of thing that seems mere infantile fun before you have a baby, but cruelty itself afterwards. I could see I might have seemed too earnest to them about the baby feeding business. They simply couldn't begin to imagine. That was almost 7 years ago, though. Have you got a good nanny? I asked as I pulled on a stretchy velvet skirt like pliable moss. I loathe her with a passion, she said, her voice muffled as she drew the dress back up. So do the children, but she's excellent. She runs the entire domestic show. I couldn't do without her. Anyway, it's good for them to realise that life isn't just about what they want all the time. It's not a picnic. Whenever I ache for another baby, I think about the whole nanny business and think again. One child was fine. I mean, it was too much for my husband. The year after she was born, he said he was wilting. He no longer felt free. Do you know that's exactly how I felt? Then in the second year, he said, I don't feel I can grow unless I leave. And dashing a manly tear from his eye, he left. I've kept the same nanny, for whom it's an ideal job. Nannies tend to jump ship at new babies, but I didn't rock the boat, and now she's like my wife. I looked at the glamorous velvet against my thighs, its pile as close as sheep-nibbled grass, soaking up light and sound. Wouldn't it be nice to be covered with this all over, I said dreamily, like a cat. What, she said, frowning, a cat suit? What's a cat suit? For an instant, I saw a cat unzip its fur and step out naked into the sun. I caught my eye in the mirror above the basin. Some days I look at my face, I might be a bit tired, and find myself thinking, that could do with a press with a damp cloth. Time marches on. Recently, a graininess like slub silk has appeared in the valley between my breasts, where a few months ago all was perfectly smooth and unmarked. It's more obvious after sleep, and rather fascinating to see age approaching in leaps and bounds. The man for whom I had not been able to spare the time was suddenly upon me, an excellent weight for those few ideal moments when my knees had been drawn up into the made-to-measure hollows of his armpits. "It's hot in here," I said, and heaved another sigh. In that cramped washroom space, trying not to catch each other's elbows or noses as we pulled garments over our heads, tugged others along our thighs, eyes averted, up in the air, musing apparently on other things, I caught glimpses of Isabel's baby-packed belly and of her extra-long limbs, more bone and health than is usually a woman's share, and wondered for a moment how she and her husband had sex together. Did she go up and catch him by the lapel like a judo wrestler? Did he rugby-tackle her from behind and bring her down like that? Or did she collapse elegantly onto a chaise longue, a giraffe, a folding ruler gradually succumbing? Perhaps there was no surrender. Possibly she was proactive in her rapprochement with her husband, chucking him under the chin, bear-hugging him, exchanging sportive punches. Hard to imagine how a very tall, strong woman comports herself here. Shrinking and passivity would look ridiculous, like a mountain trying to be a mouse. You'd have to live up to your stature and be splendid, remote, brave, ungirlish. To be big and tall and spiritless would be worse than being little and short and spiritless, as somehow more of a waste, like an uninhabited tenement building. I reflected on the spite tall women endure, as though they're not entitled to that extra length of bone, as though there's something risible about it. And frequently their woundedness in the face of this, the huddled quality, which makes them the diametrical opposites of so many short men who go around causing trouble, demanding more space and attention than they were born with, than their mothers could give them. Anyway, there was nothing passive or spiritless about Isabel. She was full of power. Back in the shop where we went to stand in front of the long mirror, a sweet-faced young salesgirl had attached herself to her splendour, eyeing her with the shrewdness of a lover, pulling out this, then that for her to try. Despite herself, Isabel was impressed. "That on you," I said excitedly of the strange item the girl had persuaded Isabel to try, pelisse-like but sleeved, pink and fawn and minutely pleated as the gills on the underside of a field mushroom. "That's so clever, like Madame de Sévigné meets Simone de Beauvoir." "Hmm," she said, staring hard at herself in the mirror. "I think it's right for you," murmured the sales girl. She was some 15 years younger than either of us, a few inches of golden stomach open to the air, her navel pierced with a diamond-tipped silver ring. Isabel and I are both in our mid-30s, the age of heroes in Russian novels, halfway through the 70s. "Try this," said the girl to Isabel, holding against her a dress in a green, the violent colour of a cricket pitch before a thunderstorm. "Yes," said Isabel slowly, nodding. The girl dropped an acid yellow mantilla over her left shoulder and we let out our collective breath with a hiss. She smiled in triumph. After that, Isabel was in the buying vein. Straight onto the yes pile went a jacket the good, honest colour of carrots and their paler core, a grey linen suit with the mauveness of dry earth, a blue and white dress like a willow pattern teacup. I cannot imagine what colour has to do with emotion, but the two are certainly inextricable. When I call my daughter to mind, I see her pale, hot eyes, a furious light blue, fair-fringed, and the coral-freckled pink pallor of her father's thin skin. My best friend, to use my daughter's terminology, appears, and her celadon eyes are full of understanding without hardness, translucent, like sage backlit, or the clear green of chives, their colour and light remarkable, as if reflected off a silver plate. When I think of women I know, I always see their eyes. With men, I see their mouths, their hands, the shape of their heads. I've tried to imagine why this is and can only conclude that it's because women and men still do not fully meet each other's gaze. Isabel's mobile phone sang out in muffled urgency from her bag. It was buried beneath a heap of bias-cut frangipani-petaled skirts and pinstripe peignoirs, pink plush toreador pants and a richly ribboned pea jacket. It rang and rang. She looked at the heap of clothes as though it cradled a howling baby. She scowled, and the frown line between her brows was like a fault line running clean through her. "Leave it," I said. "I can't even hear it." "Might be important," she said. I shrugged. It stopped after a while. Both of us ought to have been somewhere else. Both of us had too much to do. Her time is so precious that it's charged out to other people at £1 a minute. £5 a minute. 10. I never have enough time. I work an 11-hour day, excluding commuting. That means my nanny has to work a 13-hour day. I have to be out before 7 in the morning, and if I'm lucky, I'm back to kiss my daughter goodnight. Isabel's words floated back to me from that high-flying FT interview. It's unreal to say you can balance work and children. At the end of the day, you have to make up your mind whether you're going to bake cakes with them or go to work. Cakes again. Why do hard-working women always bring cakes into it when they're discussing childcare? Nobody bakes cakes these days. They're difficult to cook and bad for us. Surely we should be more concerned about the impossibility of persuading the childminder to prepare and then persuade the children to eat plain, fresh food. That's invisible work, all right. That's a labour of love. But no, it's always cakes that are mentioned. It's obviously something to do with having our cake and eating it. Do you feel guilty? I asked Isabel. What about? She said. Oh, work, I mumbled. The children. Why should I? She said. If you don't want to be financially dependent on your partner, then you have to work. That's obvious. How strange, I thought. That sounds just like the sort of thing you say before you have children. And after all the what my ex-husband would term personal growth I've been through in recent years, nothing is obvious to me anymore. Anyway, she continued, guilt is not a useful emotion. I almost fell on the floor. I had never before considered emotion in terms of its usefulness. I was amazed. Try this, said Isabel, surprising me again. And so I tried on a long, peculiar dress, yellow as a pear, with mulberry-stained panels from armpit to hem, and a sash which tied over the stomach, making a present of the wearer, like the bow on a box of chocolates. It was a wild figment. It was unhinged. And yet I stood between big Isabel and the little sales girl, and we all smiled at the mirror. Even Isabel, that expert shopping smile. The dress was made for me. The sales girl held up her fingertips in some cabalistic continental sign indicating perfection. I don't look at my reflection much these days, but now I was doing so and felt rather shy, like laughing, as though seeing a once close friend after a long time. Isabel said, "That's you. It's got that look you have. Don't mind me saying so." She was a little embarrassed. After all, we didn't know each other from Adam. These were intimate exchanges. And yet we probably saw the point of each other, the visual point, more than our husbands or ex-husbands did. Do you know that old euphemism, a bit of the other? To me, it suggests a different world just on the edge of our own, a middle earth free of the usual cares and weights. Well, this dress was a bit of the other. It was what you might wear to a middle earth party. I felt aerated and energised, the very opposite of the creeping dismay which descends when you buy and immediately know you should not have bought, so that the new garment dogs you grimly, haunts you miserably to flap at you from the touchline of your dreams. As for Isabel, she had accumulated a heap of finery and was now standing frowning by the till while they totted up how much it would cost. She looked like a baffled monarch, unable to believe that she was preparing to hand over vast sums to these illusionists. "I think these things are right for you," said the sales girl consolingly. She smiled and nodded her head and wandered back to her patch. We were now in the hands of two assiduous, bustling boys. One was removing the price tags and the other was folding and wrapping. "This gilet, it does not have a ticket," said the first boy. "How much is it?" The second boy raised a quizzical eyebrow. "150? 200, I think." He shrugged and held it in the air, hallooing up to his colleague in the chemise gallery. "How much is this, Gianni?" 300. 300, he repeated, turning back, unblinking. 350, called someone from another corner of the shop. Figures ricocheted around in the air as at an auction. No, 300, came the final estimate from the woman at the till, chimed out as though announcing a bargain. Isabel moved her head from side to side as if she'd been swimming and was trying to shake the water from her ears. After such an exchange in Vostikite, everything is so unreal that payment becomes something oddly casual and insouciant. You are anaesthetised against the usual anxiety at handing over money. It is pure thaumaturgy. I remembered my own first visit here years ago when I'd asked the price of something and politely scoffed at the answer and walked out. Then I walked around the narrow streets thinking about the silly little garment in question, and it was just like coming down with flu. Actual feverishness joined forces with a sense of suddenly lowered resistance, and I'd gone back in and handed over my money. "You've got to hand it to them," I quipped. Isabel gave a wan smile. "Let's see," she said, "I'd have to wear that dress 800 times before it came down to 30 pence a wearing. So that's 27 times a year until I'm 65. "You would spend the same on a picture," commented the woman at the till. "Is the same thing?" "Is not the same thing," hissed Isabel to me. "Have them both," I said, as she havered between two shirts, the one pale pink and the other bright Saxe blue. "You've got to make choices, Laura," she said sternly. "You can't have everything." "Why not?" I inquired. "Here, at least." I wandered off while she paid. When I returned, she sat sprawled on a chair, flushed and exhausted and leaden-eyed. Our sales girl approached with a little tray holding a crystal noggin of eau-de-vie and a few frail sugar biscuits. These Isabel wolfed down. Then she said crossly, "What are they for?" We turned and watched as a pair of cowrie-trimmed chaparejos was wrapped in silver tissue paper. "They are smart but casual," pronounced the beautiful boy who was wrapping them. "Yeah, yeah," said Isabel rudely. Back in her work clothes, the spell was wearing off. She glanced at her watch and clicked her tongue impatiently. "You can wear them anywhere," he insisted, looking up from under raven's wing brows. "Like where?" snapped Isabel. He shrugged superbly. "You can do the gardening in them," he said. "Oh, yes, of course," said Isabel, "the gardening." And at last she capitulated. She was positively wreathed in smiles. I barely recognised her. Amusement played on her face and made it appear like floating quicksilver. She was transmogrified. She had literally lightened up. "I can offer you a 5% discount," said the boy, superbly magnanimous. "Well," she gurgled, "that might just tip me over the edge." I glanced at my watch. Good grief, was that the time? It was. Things started to move fast. Her 5% was restored in a hurry. The crackling carrier bags were handed across like hot cakes, and we were out in the real world again, turfed out onto the pavement with the numberless door closed firmly behind us. "Where are you going next?" she asked. "Eastcheap." "We can share a cab," she said. "Do you know, I've got 800 pages to read before 4 o'clock. We were walking fast towards the main road, almost skipping. Her strong face was alive with pleasure and sweetness, silvery and flickering with smiles like water in the sun. "And I've got to go and interview the head of sales," I laughed. "Guilty as hell, out on his ear." "That reminds me," she said, slowing down for a moment. "Now I've paid, I want the password." "Fair enough," I said. We stopped. She stooped down and I stood on tiptoe to whisper it into her ear. She laughed aloud. That's the end.
I'm going to open up for questions in a minute, but I thought I'd get in with one of my questions first. When you were just beginning to read, you said that after, when you had all these stories together, mm-hmm. that suddenly you saw that they did hold together, that they made sense together. I was wondering what you meant.
Well, I wouldn't ever have thought that narrowness was a virtue, but sort of narrowing your subject matter down would do that. But also it was, the subject matter was so good. It was, I had the feeling when I was writing, it just was, it hadn't been done that way before.
Can you?
And it was, as you say, it was overgenerously received, really, but I thought that reviews would be hostile. I just, because I did feel breaking some sort of taboo. You know, saying things that you're not really allowed to say. Know what
I mean. Yes, I do. But because some of the people here may not have read the book, I was wondering if you could describe what the other stories.
I think, well, the subject matter of the themes, it's about women who've recently become mothers, I think, and and there's the, there's the cliche of what a mother is, and then there's the silence that.
Well, one of the things that I felt that you captured terribly well was a time of life that sort of quite a bit of my past now, but this sudden being forced to go from the kind of person you've been until you had children into this other kind of life and other kinds of feelings. And the women who are in that stage in the stories, it's almost as if they're erupting. There's a kind of anger, a kind of violence to their love and their anger and so on that I've never ever read in another story. The second story, for example, is about a visit to a cafe, isn't it?
With
the
two. Oh, that one. Yes. Yeah. I thought you meant that, Maureen. Yeah.
And it's. Could you describe that one for them?
It's partly because anything I'd ever read on the subject before having children, I'd really resented. I just thought, oh, what a moaning old spoil sport. You just don't want to be told what you don't.
And also making fun of themselves at the same time.
Yes, but things are very funny. But I think the only thing was it's just that the way things have been described or I'd read about them in literature, I'd always gone to books before for the truth, and this just wasn't covered truthfully. It seemed to me, and partly I think it's because it's a certain time of life when people are so hard pressed suddenly and very tired very often, if they're involved with this sort of level, that it's almost impossible to notice or record. And if they've got lots of help and are involved in other things of life, then it's not their subject matter.
If they move beyond it, as most people do eventually, they don't want to admit they ever had those thoughts.
But also it's almost impossible to remember as well. It's a time that it's very intense. But
well, how did you remember it then?
I can't remember it now.
But you can when you read the stories again, can you? Or
yes, but I... why I love stories is you don't have to be autobiographical. You don't have to tell your story as a novel. You can take a line in one story that's a different one in another. You can imagine your way into. It's just listening and watching and imagining your way into. Everybody takes it differently.
The stories hold together in another way, in that you have a sense that all these women live in more or less the same area, more or less the same ages, more or less the same lives, although there isn't any effort to really connect them in an obvious way. Characters do turn up in as secondary characters.
They're all mainly London, aren't they?
Yeah.
London is it.
Yeah.
I think they're very different conditions of life.
Yeah.
Some have got high-powered jobs, some aren't, some are dependent on, and some are on their own, and at different ages. There's a babysitter, she stars in one story, a lovely 17-year-old girl, and then she drops into another story in another role.
So and it's even worse.
It's sort of loosely linked like that.
But it must be quite wonderful to draw upon a group like that without ever having to give the full story and just take little...
Well, except, publishers never want you to do short stories, and I like doing short stories, and they always say they won't sell,
but
they do sell. They can sell steadily. Yeah. The other two are still in print, you see. And so, but they, somebody said to me, do linked stories. But it just seems to me a cynical thing to do. And when I've read carefully designed collections of linked stories, I feel a sort of sag and now we've got to go into the next one, and it's all going to be looped up to the one before. And I don't want it. But these, because of the narrowness of the focus, they actually. It was possible just to do it now and then without being too designing, I hope.
Did you set out to, very early in your writing life, and decide that you liked short stories and you weren't going to compromise on this, or is that just the way it happened? People are so much pressurized, poets and short story writers are pressurized into doing novels, even if it's not a form they're interested in or a form that suits their talent.
Publishers will... they always think of them as teething rings, really. Mm. And reviews always treat them as the sort of run-up to the real thing. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think novels are... They're not like short stories. Short stories aren't just short bits of long novels. They're much more like poems, in a way, I think. They're complete.
So you'd prefer to call them stories, would you? Or not?
Well, at the moment, I've always liked reading short stories, good ones. My heroes and heroines are short story writers, many of them. And when I talk to poet friends, it's the same sort of... You go to work on it in the same sort of way, I think.
Yeah.
Well, but I seem to take ages. I can take... Well, so can poets, though, but I can take 6 months doing one. I said, But I'm not ruling out novels, but...
But when you feel like it.
Well, I'm trying, yes, I've tried...
Well, Anne Beatty, the American... She's mainly a short story writer, but she writes a novel every once in a while, and she says that she's writing a short story, and then she gets this terrible feeling around page 20 that it's not going to stop. And she has to carry on this thing until it stops, which sounds...
Well,
terribly.
That's strange, because I can't imagine starting a story without knowing in advance how it would finish, I think. Well,
there's another terrible thing.
But knowing the sort of roughly where it's going to land.
Yeah.
I can't see it sort of taking off and going 5 miles away. But
well, she also never rewrites. So the novels take her about 2 minutes, very boring 2 minutes, and it goes on to the next.
Oh, no, I do rewrite, but not quite in the way. I think some... short story writers, V.S. Pritchett, he talked about he would write 100 pages, and then he talked about it like soup. He'd boil it down, and he'd condense it till it was 20 or 30 pages. And that, I can see that as one way of going at it, but some short story writers do that. It's sort of you start with a lot and go down.
Yeah, okay. What's the password? Sorry. I'll open up to a few questions from... you guys?
I see there's a short story competition that has just been started up. I went to the desk just now. Who is that? Derek Walcott, is it?
Yes, he's connected with the university now.
Mm. Yeah. Because the other thing about short stories that if you're interested in writing, people say there's not much of a market for them, but there are, in the end, if they're any good, they will get somewhere. There'll be a student magazine or a competition or scoffed at women's magazines. The fashions will come and go a bit, but there's always a space, really, eventually. So.
And where did you start out? Where did you come to
student magazine.
First? Yes. Student magazines, okay. Yeah. Are there any questions? Jeremy?
Mm. Sounds
like
you like to read poetry too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who do you like at the moment? Do you like reading most?
Well, I'm reading for a book club at the moment, Jeremy. It's been chosen for me, American Pastoral, which is it's good fun so far. It's a bit showing off. I've been rereading Colette, who I think is a tremendous writer. I like her short stories. I'm interested quite often that novelists, sometimes if they also write short stories, the short stories can be better than their novels. I think...
Thomas Mann, I'd say, disloyally.
I haven't read enough of Thomas Mann, but D.H. Lawrence, definitely. I think his stories are fantastic. Kipling, his stories are wonderful. Who's the other? The other day I said Colette and Angela Carter. Of course, I think her stories are fantastic. And she talked about stories as the story to the novel is a bit like it's not inferior or miniature or sort of slighter. It's like chamber music is to symphony music. It's just different.
Poets.
At the moment, reading. I've just been doing a Scottish story, so Liz Lockhead, Carol Ann Duffy, and Douglas Dunn's latest collection I'm reading. I like the Poetry Book Society. If anybody is interested in poetry, that's a nice way of. It comes through the post 4 times a year. It's quite cheap. I think it's about £25 a year, or 20. But you get a good newsletter and. I look forward to that. That's the only sort of giveaway magazine I enjoy. And then you get the choice. And it's a little sense of community I don't find with novelists at all. Yeah. I've always been along to the Poetry Society. I like poetry readings.
Are there any other questions? Peter?
No, I just remember. I remember that.
Research like that, going out with your butterfly net to collect exotic animals.
Not at all. No, it's that was just some fun, really. With it, the way many people talk now, it's in sub therapy terms. It's culled from this sort of particular phrase. You know, that's not useful to you. Don't feel it. And when it's absorbed, like, I just find it terribly funny and shocking sometimes. So that, well, I was just making fun of that, really. I suppose it's language, actually, the poetry. It's the interest in language more than you get in many novels. And you can do it in stories. You've got time to pay attention more, to play more with the surface, perhaps, to get certain effects. It's not so tiresome over a short distance to to have the language denser and perhaps more tricksy. Yeah.
Would you go out of your way to, if something, this was suggested, something you might do, would you think about it in terms of whether it would be useful to you or not, whether you might find some interesting words or feelings out of doing
it? Would you go to that shop or its equivalent, which I suspect is on the Fulham Road?
What are you wearing? Well, it is a craze among shops now to sort of not allow the customers near it, which is a very good buying gambit.
Fantastic. Why did you do research, like, to actually go into some of these shops, or did you imagine it all?
Well, I don't know. Just certain things amuse me. I read about that, I think. I thought that's and then you combine it with maybe other shops you've been to or certain... the sort of magical rites that sales assistants practice. The sort of collusion, the fun.
Did you use the word thaumaturgy or something? At the hill? Oh, right. I always wondered what that word meant. Is it magic?
It's a sort of magical dramatic effect, I think. It's, yeah. Well, it's the science of magical dramatic effect. Sorry, yeah.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting. I've sort of partly allowed just thinking of whatever you're obsessed with at the time. If it's over a distance of a couple of years or so, it'll have some unity of its own, perhaps, the sorts of things that are interesting you. But then there does come a point, round about number six, I suppose, and for a collection you should have 9, 10, 11, maybe. And then you start thinking of the shape. I'll start rather nice... playing, you have postcards with the six on and you put them in various shapes and think, oh, I need a bit of blue up there and I want something funny there, I think, and then start seeing it in a shape, I suppose.
Is there a
balance?
The type of story, do you find it either easy, or do you think you write better stories when they're more spontaneous, or does it actually help when you've got a focus?
Oh, well, that's partly the, if you get commissioned, whether some people like a commission very much, it starts them off. And I've done that once or twice, and it has worked, but it's very nerve-wracking. There was one Sunday paper wanted one for a particular date, and I took 5 weeks, and I thought that was quick, you know. And he said, I thought it was a good story, I thought, but it wasn't enough narrative for them. And, of course, a paper needs a lot going on.
And they're very bossy.
And it's still a fortnight. I said, while writing that, I'd had other on the theme they wanted, and so I went and did one in a fortnight, which is my world record, I think. And but I don't like taking commissions, really. But usually, if somebody asks for something, it's so vague, the commission, it'll be something like, oh, you do a story for Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
As long as you're vaguely, you know, sort of dealing with human life, anything can fit that, pretty much.
There's also this vogue for themed anthologies. And
do you enjoy reading them? Do you mean things that are commissioned to fit a theme?
Yeah, so there are lots of different stories on one thing.
Yeah.
It depends. It depends on what the story
is. I've not seen them work terribly well very often, because
apparently
if people approach it as writing an article, you know, sort of, oh, I've got to get that in by that deadline, and it's all going to be... They feel a bit cooked up sometimes, don't they? Hmm. But they shouldn't. They should just be allowed the time they take, really.
Yeah, but as far as that kind of commission, writing for Valentine's Day, you're writing a story that has one particular kind of thing in it, one element. Does that work for you, or is that an obstruction? You know,
I wouldn't go about it thinking I'm going to choose that theme. No, absolutely not. No, just a feeling, more in a certain feeling, you know, and you just work on that.
Any other? Yes, up there.
Well, that's very kind of you. That's just me. I haven't cultivated it. I think that's subjective as well. That's nice of you as a reader. No.
When you say you're taking such a long time over the story, 6 months for a story, what is...
Not always,
but what
sometimes.
Is the time? Where does the time go? Is it the... where do you get stuck? Or is it just...
Well, it's just the luxury of being able to get something as perfect as you like. And if you do journalism and fiction, if you've done both, and journalism's always this business of having to do it at the deadline, so many pounds per paragraph, and it's just awful, really, in the end. And that's one sort of work, making money out of words. I'm just not going to do that with fiction, you know?
Not
just
rushing.
Allow
utter
luxury and be haughty and not worry about if it sells or anything. Just wait till it's ready and... Sometimes it just gets stuck for a while. You have to be patient.
Yeah, but this is a more... I mean, it's a luxury being stuck in a way. But I was just asking, when you're going slowly, how do you luxuriate in this wonderful state? Do you write it over and over?
Oh, it's not usually on purpose. No, it's usually life. It's usually having to do lots of other things. It's usually, you know, what everybody finds.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. People say, if you want to write... Do many people want to write here?
Yes.
They do.
Yes,
well,
they're already writing.
There's always this thing about, if you want to write, you'll find the time, you'll somehow manage it, why not get up at 5 a.m? Which is, I think, downright cruel sometimes. You know, there are certain times of your life when it's foolish. After a while, you sort of know that there are certain minimum conditions for everybody, I think. And you have to work at... It's not just an excuse finding basic right conditions. It doesn't... Some people can manage to sit in cafes or get up at 5 or whatever, but you have to know your own energies and look after them and find a little space and somehow protect it. But it's cruel to just say it'll happen anyway if you've got it in you.
But do you find that when you do make time in your sort of very busy life to write, is it very, very hard to go back? I say a leading question, very hard to go back to your other...
Well, yes,
work,
I think some people...
in the trance.
The real... people who do manage life very successfully and can practice art as well are the ones who go from first to fourth gear, zoom like that. And there are others who go first to second, second to third, you know, and then coming down again. Oh God, getting back into first. If it takes an hour or two each way,
there's no time in the middle.
Unfortunately, you know, it ought to. If you can manage 3 hours a day and then you've got a busy life outside, that should be fine. And for some people, that fits what they can do and how they work, and they can write beautifully like that, but others just want whole days and nights when they don't have to speak to someone. You know, that's how they, you know, writers like that, and they just work like that.
Yeah. Well, I can do a nice 3-hour fiction day, get things done, and then I hate everybody for the rest of the day. Mm. So that's no good.
I don't want you to speak.
Mm. Are there any other questions? Yes, up there.
It's not. I don't think stories should ever have that trick thing. You know, that they've got to follow through. Though there's a lot of stories that start with a feeling and you love them, but they don't actually. You end and there's nothing. You know, you've been left with an impression, but nothing's been achieved. It's not over. And I, the only thing I can think of is like with, you know, following through, you hit the thing, you follow it. So I don't usually know what will happen at the end exactly, but I'll know where it's going. I suppose with pre-writing, it's not so much words. I sometimes lay out sheets of paper on the ground and think it's going to be about that long, because I know a sheet is 250 words for my handwriting. And I'll have a sort of rough plan, I suppose. Various. Sorry? No, I don't. No, it's different from novel writing, because it's more with stories. It's suggestion. It's a remark. You don't actually want to know where they went to school and, you know, what, and so on. It's not. It'll just creep up. It should be a feeling around the character. But the business of laying out sheets of paper, that it's more like I imagine sketching out rough for a painting. It's that feeling of shape. Some sort of, you know. It's got to go up there. It's got to really get interesting there, and then it can go down a bit. Finish off with
the pacing in a way, or the rhythm.
Yes. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But in spatial terms, yeah.
I suppose it's something. Yeah. It sounds a bit.
It sounds very novelistic. You're going to be condemned
to write
a novel.
Well, no, it sounds the opposite
to
a novel, really. Maybe a novel would work like that. It's just the feeling of a story. You can always reread. I was talking to someone who is writing a novel, and they were saying. They like to reread it before they start work each day. And I mean, so when it gets to a certain length, it's going to take you 5 hours before you can get going. You know, and with a story, you can always scan it and see where you, and pick up in that way. So.
Yes.
Yes, I've done that. Yes, that is a bit in here, but in other stories I've done. In the second collection, Dear George, I did that a lot. Yeah, and the first one. Well, I've talked to women our mother's age more, and they say, well, we didn't used to have reasons. It just, you know, there wasn't a choice. You just had them, full stop. And with very basic birth control. Anyway, but everybody did have them unless they couldn't have them. And it's only very recently people have sat around for 10 years saying, I don't know, can I stand the lack of independence? But then, I don't know, you know, would I be too tired? And is a child? And you get this very funny scenario of people coming around when you've had your first baby and sort of looking at you saying, is it worth it then? And I don't believe that ever happened to our mothers. You know, it's a sort of seen as a... some sort of time-out choice, you know.
I remember having a toddler, my first toddler, and having friends using me that way, and couples coming over and playing with the child and looking at each other. It's going to be wonderful. And then the toddler would do something awful, and they'd look at each other, no, we're not going to do this. Back and forth. I think we have room for another question or two. Are there any others? Any other? Everybody's hiding their hands. Okay.
I think it's important to get, for people to, if they're interested in writing, it's nice to get in print, something in print. And it might be interesting to know what there is available at the moment. There used to be a lot of women's magazines who did fiction. Good Housekeeping did William Trevor and
but
people, and Cosmo
not as
did.
Much, not as much.
And they did really good fiction, yeah. They might seem in themselves, Cosmo for instance, but the fiction was very good. There's not so much of that now. There's places like the New Yorker, but you have to be pretty grand or lucky to get in there. But there is new writing. That's the vintage paperback. And I think it's the 10th one this year. It's run by the British Council. And but it's less worthy than lots of these collections for new writing. You actually want to buy it. It's new writing by established writers, people of 80, as well as people who haven't had anything published at all. And it's the only place I know it's a genuine forum for... You know, you'd be pleased to get something in there. It would be seen. And
In the U.S., there are so many presses connected to various universities that fill a role that the commercial presses don't want to fill. And that could always... That's starting to happen here as well, but there just aren't enough of them yet. I hope there will be more.
Yes, but I always want... I mean, if you write, you do almost want to not be a charity case or not be
encouraged. These are very respectable. These are not people publishing their students, but people of presses that are run by universities for writing, to receive writing from the entire country, from people. So it's not, they're not doing vanity publishing of their own people, and that's why they're respected. But they are available in the good, the serious bookstores and so on.
Or hope to start something like that. Here?
Yeah. Well, yeah. We don't know yet. Excuse me.
Magazines.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We have, but not a press yet. Are there any other questions? One final one from me then. Why do you think this sort of false view of short stories? How did it evolve in this country? This idea that it's some kind of lesser form, it doesn't sell, it can't be judged on its own terms. Don't write them.
I think possibly people always talk about the wartime as being the golden age of short stories, but there were I was reading a lot of them in anthologies recently, and lots of them are very poor. That's the trouble. I mean, it's easy to write a bad short. It's easier to write a bad short story than a novel because it's shorter, for a start. And once you've been put off the form and you've read a few which just have a trick at, the twist in the tale, and you just think, well, that's hardly worth reading, then you may be turned off the form. Perhaps that's partly what's done it. I don't know, because in America it's flourishing.
Yeah. But it is supported by all that, by that machinery of the presses.
But it's partly a habit, like anything else. Once you start reading them and find someone you love, you read more of them. You start wanting to read one a day, two a day, or you feel lost without.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming this evening, and thank you very much, too. And hope you come again.
Thank you.